To tell you the truth, I think she's been a bit sweet on Mr. Bill's eldest ever since he brought him in for a half pint before he went off to join the army. Mr. Beale probably doesn't know this, but young Billy came back of his own accord a couple of times when he came home on leave just to see our Viv before he went over there. Phil frowned on it a bit, but as he said, at least he knows Mr. Beale's lads are good boys. An image of Billy's son came into Maisie's mind's eye. A boy of 8 or 9 when she first met him, with wheaten hair like his father and a swagger to his step. Young Billy, always with a cheeky grin, taking on the job of helping his father keep the family morale high, even through the worst of times. She remembered him coming into the office before leaving for France, filled with that confidence and proud in his new uniform, talking about how long it took him to get his boots to a spit-and-polish shine. And when Maisie had said, "Take care, young Billy," and had pressed 4 half-crowns into his hand, he had blushed and said,
"Thanks, Miss Dobbs. This'll buy me and the boys a few pints before we go."
His father had walked to the door with him and had returned to the office, his head low. Maisie could feel Sandra's eyes upon her. They both understood what the news meant for Billy and his family. The question now was whether she should tell Billy what she knew or leave it to the Paith News to inform him. After all, perhaps his son might not be at risk.
"You won't say anything to anyone, will you, Miss Dobbs? Miss Pickering, I should have kept my mouth shut. After all, it's not as if I should know anything, but our Viv was so upset she just had to get it off her chest."
"We'll both keep it to ourselves, Mrs. Coombs," said Maisie. "I'm sure that if the BEF are indeed stranded, it will be in the newspapers at some point during the next few days, and I'd already heard something along those lines from another source."
"Our boys are fighting for their lives, and ours over there. And if they lose, if Hitler gets closer, it'll only be a question of time before invasion. That's what worries me. People will lose their sons, and then we'll lose our country. And let's face it, it won't be the first time. As Phil says, look at the Romans and the Normans and the Saxons before them. And those Saxons were German, after all. Little island like this, we're sitting ducks. I don't know what will come of us. Truly, I don't. At least mine are in reserved occupations, that's all I can say. But no one will be protected come the invasion."
Maisie escorted Sally Coombs downstairs to the front door, opening it wide to a shaft of sunlight. Before bidding her goodbye, she reassured the woman. "I will keep in touch, Mrs. Coombs, and I dare say I will have something to report next Monday, if not before."
"Who knows what might have happened by then," said Coombs, as she stepped out into Fitzroy Square.
As Maisie collected the afternoon post from the table, she heard a key in the lock, the door opened again, and Billy crossed the threshold.
"Lovely afternoon, miss. Really feels like spring has sprung. And there's Sally Coombs walking down the road, bundled up for a blizzard."
They began walking up the stairs together, Maisie listening while Billy talked about who he'd seen on the walk from the underground station.
"Now I could do with a cuppa,"
he continued his chatter before Maisie could respond.
"Sandra here? Lovely. Can't wait to see the little fellow again. I'll bet he's a bonny boy. I remember when my young Billy was that age. I tell you, when my first boy was born, I felt like everything was getting better. I mean, I'd married my best girl, and now I had a boy."
Sandra came to her feet to greet Billy as they entered the office, but before she could speak, Billy looked from Sandra to Maisie.
"What? Something's off. What is it?"
Maisie was used to thinking on her feet, making snap decisions when a life was threatened or an investigation was reaching a crucial point. Given what she knew of Doreen's vulnerability in the face of bad news and the threat of mental breakdown that had never quite left her, she might be able to circumvent Billy's wife's suffering a serious psychological response to her son's life being at risk. If Billy knew now about the situation in France, It would give him time to reach Doreen before news left Westminster for Fleet Street, before the morrow's early newspapers were stacked onto trains, trains that would take the escalating news to every household in the country, news of Britain's vulnerable army fighting for its life, and a possible eventual evacuation of the expeditionary force from the coast of France, an army of men, of husbands, brothers, sweethearts, sons, and yes, daughters too, for she knew there were young women ambulance drivers and telephonists with the Auxiliary Territorial Service over in France. Maisie remembered being at Chelstone in the spring of 1918. Why was she there? Was she convalescing, following her own wounding in France? Yes, it must have been, because she was walking at a slow pace through the village. If she moved any faster, she would lose her balance. She had watched as the messenger boy went from house to house. Soon, it seemed, everyone was on the street, women calling to each other, telling children to find the men working out in the fields. "Who have we lost? Who have we lost?" they cried, each holding out their own telegram, just delivered following the spring offensive. For everyone knew everyone else, and every boy had grown to manhood with a family of mother, father, and village. A man and woman might have lost their son, but they had also lost his best friends, and the boys who had played football together in the street after school, and cricket on the green in summer. "Who have we lost?" the words echoed in her ears.
"What, miss? What is it? Is it Doreen? Our little Lizzie?"
Maisie knew then that she must tell Billy, for instead of asking for Margaret Rose, his youngest child, who had been evacuated to the country with her mother, he had uttered the name of a daughter now dead, dear little Lizzie Beale, who had succumbed to diphtheria so long ago. An ingrained fear of loss had caused him to call out the wrong name. She must give him the opportunity to reach Doreen before news reached her first. Surely they had time, and surely planned, on the part of the government, meant that something might not need to be put into action. There might still be a chance of success. After all, the information she'd received could be incorrect, superseded by developing events. But this was war, not a game. And if it were true that Churchill had given instructions for plans for evacuation of the BEF to be drawn up, it meant that the situation was grave.
"Billy, you know Vivian at the pub is a telephonist on the government exchanges and..."
"What of it?"
Billy frowned. His tone had become short. "She's bound by the Official Secrets Act, but she told her mother and father that she had overheard a conversation between callers at a very high level, discussing orders for a possible evacuation of the expeditionary force in France. The Germans have moved into the Netherlands and Belgium, and it is feared it will only be a matter of time before France falls. Our army is in fierce combat with the Germans, and already men are making their way to the coast of northern France." Billy ran the fingers of one hand after the other through his hair.
"Believe me now, they're still digging up soldiers from the last war across that Somme valley, and now there'll be even more."
He rested his head in his hands.
"My son, my boy, what will we do? What will Doreen do? We can't lose him."
Instinctively, Maisie moved to his side. Sandra checked the sleeping baby in his carry cot and stepped across toward the door.
"I'll make tea. We could all do with a cup."
Billy pointed at the carry cot.
"Make sure you take that boy somewhere where they're neutral, Sandra. Make sure you and Lawrence get away and take him where no one will ever be knocking on the door and wanting him for soldiering."
"Billy, I brought the motor car with me this morning, and I'll drive you down to Hampshire without delay if you think it best to go to Doreen. I just have to place a couple of telephone calls and I'll be ready to go."
"What about the petrol, miss?"
I've Motor Spirit coupons in my bag, so I'm all right. Let's think ourselves lucky, as I was about to retire the Elvis to the barn at Chelstone for the duration. Billy sat down on the chair vacated by Mrs. Coombs. He leaned forward with his arms folded and resting on his knees, his gaze toward the floor. When he spoke, his voice was low.
I know there's thousands of lads over there, and I feel for every one of them, and their mums and dads and their wives, their children. But I never wanted my Billy to go, not after what I saw the last time round. And they said it would be different. War's always the same, though. Politicians square off and ordinary lads do their dirty work. I'd stick all of them ministers in a field, all of them. All of these big knobs from every country what wants a fight, and I'd let them have all their blooming weapons and tell them to get on with it. Leave us ordinary people alone to live our lives. That's what I'd do.
Maisie knew it would be of no use to comment. His need now was to be with his family.
What'll I do about Bobby?
Billy wiped his hand across his forehead.
I can't believe it. For a minute I forgot all about my other boy.
It's all right, Billy. You're reacting as anyone might in your situation. Now then, let's plan to leave within the hour, and I'll have you down to Hampshire in next to no time.
Won't the train be faster?
Said Sandra as she returned to the room with a tray set, with a teapot, milk jug and sugar. She set it down on her desk and moved to pick up two cups and saucers along with the china mug favoured by Maisie, which were kept on top of the filing cabinet.
Billy, what do you think?
Asked Maisie.
The train might be faster, but first I've got to get on one going to Whitchurch, and then there's the bus from there to the village. Well, Hamlet, more like, closer to Doreen's aunt's, and I've got to walk after that.
Right, here's what we'll do, Billy. I'll take you, no arguments. Sandra, can you get a message to young Bobby? Let him know his dad has had to go down to Hampshire for work. She turned back to Billy. I'm sure he can look after himself, but is there anyone you want to look in on him?
Mrs. Ralph, the neighbour. She's a good one, and she's taken a shine to Bobby, said she reminds him of the boy she lost on the Somme.
Right. Sandra, would you get a messenger to take a note to Mrs. Ralph? Ask her to kindly look out for Bobby when he gets home from work. She turned to Billy. Didn't you tell me he's doing a lot of overtime at the garage? Converting motor cars for war work?
He won't be home before 7. Like I said this morning, I don't even see him much on a Sunday because he's so tired. He's not out of bed before noon.
Not to worry, miss. I'll look after everything.
Sandra reached for the telephone receiver.
I'll get Lawrence, and we'll drive over to Billy's later if need be. And don't you worry either, Billy. He'll be all right. Bobby's more or less a man now anyway, so we won't want too many women fussing over him.
He might be a man, Sandra, but just like his brother, he's still my boy.
Chapter 3 Billy was leaning forward in the passenger seat of the Elvis, as if doing so would make the vehicle go faster. His eyes were focused on the road before them, and each time traffic slowed or a bus pulled out in front of the motor car, he made his complaint known with a shaking of the fist or a curse directed toward the driver. Errant pedestrians received a loud sigh, with the exception of a woman, dawdling, who was treated to a Billy winding down the side window and telling her to get a move on. Maisie knew his impatience reflected fear for his wife's emotional vulnerability and terror for his son.
"You know what it does, miss, don't you?"
said Billy, leaning back in the passenger seat.
"It brings it all back. That's the worst thing about being in a war. It's not the fighting or the tunnelling or any of the bleeming terrible jobs you have to do. No, it's the waiting. For us sappers, it was waiting for the coast to be clear, laying lines, going into tunnels, putting down explosives, waiting to get out, waiting to get in, waiting to go over the top. It's the waiting that makes a brave lad cave into himself. Once you get going, once you're doing something, you get this sort of sort of feeling like a bottle of pop just went off inside you, and you get on and do your job, and when it's done, you drop. But waiting's terrible. Waiting bears down on you. They don't tell you about that when you've just enlisted and you're square bashing and blighty. No, you find it out once you're over there, up to your eyes in it. I saw a bloke go down once, all his insides outside of him. I got to him and said, "You're all right, mate. Stretcher bearers are coming." And he looked up and said, "Thank God, the waiting's over." And that was him, gone. And now there's all them lads over there.
Billy sighed as he settled in for the journey. Houses, shops and factories were thinning out as they began to pass fields, farms and woodland. Maisie understood only too well how important it was for her to counter Billy's intensity with her own modulated breathing, with measured movements and responses. The fire inside her assistant was burning with a fury. She would not fan the flames. Instead, she meditated upon her driving and being safe and secure inside a shell of protection. A temper was akin to a virus and could so easily graft itself into another.
"You're going to have to direct me once we get close to Alton." "The last stretch is all winding road out to the village. It's a terror to get to. Fair wears me out, it does. Doreen says they should come home, what with nothing happening. She found out that a lot of Margaret Rose's friends who were evacuated have gone home too, and the part of the school not taken over by the army is back in use, with a couple of teachers coming in every day. We don't like being apart, though I sometimes think Bobby quite likes a bit of freedom when I'm off seeing his mum and sister."
He fell silent, then added,
"They're good boys, my lads. A bit of lip here and there, but they're a pair of diamonds, both of them."
"Tell me what happened at Yates's yard," said Maisie. Not only was she eager to know, but the conversation would distract Billy. "It's been a rush since you came back into the office," she added. Billy looked at his watch.
"Blimey, I can hardly believe it was only this morning. Don't take long for the world to tip, does it?"
"No, Billy, sadly, it doesn't," said Maisie.
"Well, anyway," said Billy,
taking a notebook from his inside pocket. He opened and then closed it again.
"I'd better not read while you're driving. Makes me a bit queasy. I can remember it all."
"Open the window if you're feeling unsettled, Billy."
"I'll be all right."
He paused, ran his fingers through his hair, took one swift glance at his notebook again, and looked ahead at the road.
"I got to the works and asked to speak to Mike Yates, but he wasn't there on account of having to go to visit a site. I should have said when I got there, I went in through the big gates, cast iron, they are, leading onto a cobblestone yard with drains, because they used to have horses and carts to take men in the paints and what have you to the jobs, but it's all vans and lorries now, with all their tools and paint stored in the old stables. There was a lorry just getting ready to leave, a couple of blokes climbing into the cab, and it was an ordinary lorry, not RAF or Army. They just delivered paint in big tins. Now, I'm not a painter or a decorator, so I don't know if this is normal, but these tins were more like barrels, and there were blokes from Yates's in their whites, already starting to pour the stuff into smaller containers, then putting them into the back of a van."
"That's interesting. Were any of the men wearing masks?"
"You mean like doctors? Or crooks?" Billy grinned.
"Glad to see your sense of humour hasn't completely vanished." Maisie gave a half laugh. "No, I meant like doctors. It occurred to me that if this paint, emulsion, Joe called it, is sufficiently vaporous to cause headaches, I wonder if wearing some sort of mask might help, and if they wore them at the yard when they're decanting the bigger containers."
"No, they weren't."
Billy paused, thoughtful.
"Well, I tell a lie. One bloke had tied an old rag round his face, over his nose and mouth. And there's more to tell on that."
"Go on," said Maisie.
"I went up to the bloke with the paperwork. He looked like he was ticking off the number of barrels. And first of all, I asked him if Mr. Yates was there, and when he said no, I said, Perhaps you can help me then. So I asked him about Joe Coombs and he said, Oh, he's not here. He's on a job outside London. I asked him if he could tell me where, and he said he couldn't, because it was... What did he say?
Billy pressed his lips together as he tried to remember the conversation.
Classified. That's what he said. It was classified. He said Joe was working on a special...
Billy opened his notebook, glanced at the pages and closed it again, rubbing his eyes.
A special government works order. Then the bloke clammed up and asked, And who are you? So I told him I was there because Joe's dad was a mate of mine and couldn't get away from work to come over himself, but him and his missus were a bit worried as they hadn't heard from young Joe, and they thought he might be poorly, as he'd complained of having a bit of a head a few times. And he says, Oh, we all get a bit of that, mate. It's paint what does it, especially this new stuff. That's why Bert over there has a towel tied round his face. Then he told me it was all right, because the lads are mainly working outside, so the fumes get dispersed.
Maisie was silent, as if the information imparted were a stone found at the beach, a pebble shot through with thin veins of strata, to be traced and considered as she turned the rock in her palm.
What do you think of that, miss?
Did he say anything else? Asked Maisie.
Not much. Only that the older men look out for the apprentices, but at that age they said Joe should have been pretty much able to look after himself.
Billy stared out of the window, then brought his attention back to Maisie.
Trouble is, they all think they're men, these young lads, and even though I know what he meant, the bloke at Yates's Yard, 15 and already at work for a year, gives you a bit more news than you had when you left school. But take it from me, there's still something of the boy there, and without the beard of a man.
And Joe is so attached to his family. Yet I have a feeling that he knew he would be able to establish some independence with his work. He was breaking away from Phil and Sally to grow that beard, but this government job is beginning to sound like more and more of a risk. She paused. Do I go right here, Billy?
Oops, yes, sorry, miss. I was miles away then, thinking...
Anyway, it sounds as if the government wanted the work done as fast as possible and sent the painters out with the best fire retardant they had to hand, and perhaps they hadn't gone through a full testing.
Perhaps they didn't want to, said Billy.
You could be right.
Look, as soon as I've dropped you at the cottage, I'll find a room at a local guest house. It shouldn't be too difficult, but still pushing it a bit, as it will... be getting dark by then. Luckily, we're making good time, but I don't want to be out after the blackout.
Tomorrow I'll have a look round, find out where Joe is staying, talk to the landlady, that sort of thing. It's a big country, but at least I know roughly where he was lodging, according to the notes taken when I spoke to Mrs. Coombs. I should telephone Brenda, too, find out how Anna is this week. There have been some bugs going round, but so far she's managed to remain well.
The things they pick up at school. When I was a boy, if anything was going round, mumps, chicken pox, measles, my mum used to say, go on, get in there and get it, and then you'll be done with it. Makes me laugh to think of it. There's some who take very bad, though. My cousin went down with chicken pox, and they put her in quarantine because they thought she had smallpox. That's another nasty one.
Billy seemed to stare into the distance as if the past were on the road in front of him, then sat forward in his seat.
Matt's turning there, miss, with the pillar box at the end of the lane.
Maisie swung the motor car onto the lane, continuing along the bumpy road until they reached a cottage at the edge of farmland.
Miss is it, said Billy.
How far is it from the station? Asked Maisie.
3 or 4 mile, said Billy.
And you walk all the way?
Unless I can get a lift from the farmer, if he's coming this way. Doreen's aunt's husband, God rest his soul, was one of the farm workers from the time he was a boy, and the farmer said the tied cottage is hers until she dies.
Oh, look, there's Doreen with Margaret Rose now. Maisie slowed the motor car, bringing it to a halt alongside the cottage, She shut off the engine and stepped out of the Elvis, watching as Billy's daughter ran and launched herself into his arms, while Doreen stood back, watching, smiling, yet with a questioning look in her eyes, until Billy held out a hand to bring her into his embrace. Maisie caught her breath, and for a moment she imagined laughing with James as their child ran to his arms, and then feeling his arms around them both, a family of three, beloved of each other. But James was gone now, along with all hope of motherhood, and at times Maisie thought she might lose the feeling of him, lose the image of his face, of his touch, of him reaching for her. She looked away, but heard Doreen call her name.
"Miss Dobbs! Maisie, would you like to stay for tea? You must be gasping for a cup and something to eat."
"Come on in, miss. We've been on the road for a few hours now," added Billy.
Maisie shook her head. If she were to secure accommodation for the night, she should make haste to find her way back to a guest house she had noted as they drove through Whitchurch.
"I should be getting along. I've to settle a room for the night." "You can stay here on the farm, Miss Dobbs," said Doreen's aunt as she emerged from the house, wiping her hands on a tea-cloth and introduced herself as Aunt Millicent, as if everyone referred to her as aunt, whether related or not.
"They run a bed and breakfast up at the house, you know. The farmer's wife, Mrs. Keep, puts up a very good spread of a morning."
Realizing she had little choice, the group's faces were wreathed in smiles of welcome and all but dictated her next move, Maisie inclined her head and accepted the referral.
"I'll nip along to see Mrs. Keep now," she consulted her watch,
"and then I might have just enough time to go back into Whitchurch before it gets dark."
She turned to Billy.
"I want to find out where Joe is staying. Have a word with the landlady. I've got his last address."
"Right you are, Mish,"
Billy nodded, acknowledging Maisie's tactful decline of tea. By the time she had seen Mrs. Keep, it was likely that Doreen would be in a state of distress, for Billy would have recounted what he knew of the battles raging on the other side of the channel, and the fact that there were plans being made to evacuate the army. Maisie wondered if being privy to classified information in advance of the general population was as useful as it appeared at first blush, and she found herself wishing she had placed a call to Dr. Elsbeth Masters, the doctor of psychiatry, to whom she had referred Doreen years before, in the wake of little Lizzie Beale's death. Although Billy's wife was stronger, this news of what was happening in France might distress her to the point of relapse. But Billy was with her, so at least she had someone there to share the weight of her deepest fears, and they had come through so much together. Mrs. Keep was as good as her name. She kept a tidy house, neat accommodation, and a fair price for a room, which looked out over the kitchen garden and beyond to a field with cattle grazing and a hill flanked by a stand of oaks in the far distance. At ease in the small room with sloping beamed ceilings, Maisie closed her eyes as she stood in front of the diamond-paned window. An image of the restful landscape before her seemed etched behind her lids, as if it were a photographic negative. But she could not linger and give way to fatigue. After paying Mrs. Keep for one night, she left the house to search for a Mrs. Digby, who apparently took in lodgers, including the young Joe Coombs. Mrs. Digby resided in a house on the Winchester Road, not far from the River Test and the old silk mill. Billy had told her something of the town during the drive down from London, informing her that the silk mill was built in 1815, but that silk only began to be made 2 years later, when a silk manufacturer from London bought the property. The mill had garnered some prestigious clients, and more recently, Billy had been told by a local that not only was the mill continuing to make silk for shirting and legal gowns, and for the company started by Thomas Burberry, but was also weaving silk for the insulation of electrical cables. It appeared the machine of war was in operation everywhere. Maisie had been directed to the house by the landlord of a local pub. It seemed there was a pub on almost every corner of the small town. and according to the plaque above the door of the three-story residence, it had been built in 1790. It appeared somewhat down at heel, and for the time being had probably been saved from complete collapse by ivy leaching into every crevice of the brickwork, though that same ivy could well be the culprit undermining the mortar. Maisie knocked at the door, and when there was no answer, knocked again. No one came. She stood back and looked up at the windows, then back at the door, and only then noticed a bell pull to the right, partially obscured by creeping vine. She took the rusty cast-iron handle and gave it a good tug. This time she did not have to wait long for a response to her summons.
All right, I'm coming. What's the rush? That's what I want to know.
A woman's voice, husky, interrupted by a throaty cough, grew louder on the other side of the door.
I'm here just a minute.
The yapping of a small dog inspired a scolding and another round of coughing before the door was opened.
Yes? What can I do for you?
Maisie estimated Mrs. Digby to be about 50 years of age, though she appeared to be doing all she could to combat the years. Dressed in a silk kimono over a pair of silk pajamas, both had seen better days, and perhaps not much in the way of laundry soap in recent weeks or months. Digby was heavily made up, with copious amounts of powder and rouge. Maisie wondered if the woman had been on the stage, for the texture of the cosmetics reminded her of those used by Priscilla's youngest son, Tarkin, when he had been given the role of Peter Pan in the school pantomime. Regarding Mrs. Digby, Maisie remembered Douglas Partridge looking down at his son and inquiring whether he had put on the makeup with a trowel. It was so thick. The woman's eyes were bright blue, rimmed by long, thick lashes that could only be false. She held a petite white dog under her arm and jigged it up and down as if it were a babe on her hip to be soothed. Maisie thought the dog looked more like a powder puff with eyes, nose, tongue, and teeth than something reliably canine. Mrs. Digby? The woman seemed to assess Maisie from head to toe, then smirked and raised an eyebrow as if to have found the subject wanting.
And who wants to know?
Maisie reached into her pocket and brought out a calling card. She handed it to Mrs. Digby, who held out a liver-spotted hand with beringed fingers, her nails manicured to show bright red polish to best effect. She took the card.
Psychologist and investigator, eh? And you want to investigate me?
Maisie shook her head. No, Mrs. Digby. I'm here informally on behalf of very good friends of mine. Their son was lodging with you, and they haven't heard from him in a week or so, and of course they are worried.
You must mean Freddy. Or was it Len? I've only got the ladies now, 3 WAAFs, stationed at the RAF base. Mind you, when the lads were here, it was all above board. Men on the top floor, women on the floor just above mine. I don't want any funny business going on under my roof.
Then you didn't let a room to Joe Coombs? Asked Maisie. The woman flapped a free hand.
Oh, Joe! Little Joey, I almost forgot him. Mind you, easy to do, as he was a quiet one.
Was?
They moved on over a week ago. Probably why his people haven't heard from him.
I thought the men were still working in the area at the airfield. Digby repositioned the dog on her hip.
Well, there's more than one airfield within striking distance, and not many places left to lodge.
What with all the WAAFs,
and they say we'll have land girls coming in before too long. Not that the young ladies are easier, leaving their knickers and stockings to drip all over the floor when they've washed them out in the sink, and the noise they make when they're getting ready to go out of an evening, I can hardly think. It's like a herd of elephants above my head. She paused. No, there were three of them, the lads, and they moved out.
The woman's words seemed to fade as she glanced at the ground, frowning. What is it? Said Maisie.
Digby shook her head. Probably nothing. But that boy was having terrible headaches. I mean, the other boys had headaches too. I put it down to the fact that they liked to go down to the pub of an evening. But with young Joe, it was bad. He asked me for a powder once or twice, and I could see it was hurting. Then all of a sudden, they were giving notice. The big lads, Freddy, came to see me, said they were moving out, and that was that.
When was the last time you saw Joe Coombs, Mrs. Digby? The woman stared over Maisie's head and squinted, as if the answer might lie amid the trees on the other side of the road.
I reckon it was the day before they left. They were generally off to work before it's my time to get up of a morning. They knew how to make themselves a breakfast, and as long as I don't come down to a pile of dirty plates and cups in the sink, I let my lodgers look after themselves. Then, that one came back to say they'd moved on, but he didn't give an address. He brought the van and collected their belongings. Not that they had much. A small kit bag each, and that was it. I've seen evacuees turn up in the town with more. I know the lads were all working for a London firm, painting and decorating, that sort of trade, and I knew it was to do with airfields, so I assumed they were doing up the officers' mess at each place, something like that. I'd been paid up until the end of next month, so I was all right.
And they didn't give you an address for forwarding post? Asked Maisie.
No. Joe was the only one to get any letters in any case. Just a minute.
Digby held up a finger and walked back into the house. Maisie peered through the open doorway. A staircase swept up from a narrow hall, which had been painted red with a blue border, and a paper chain of dusty Union Jack flags hung in a shallow curve from the picture rail. A mirror was situated above a hall table where post had been spread out. Still holding the white dog on her hip, Digby held each letter up to her face, revealing a need for reading glasses and a disposition too vain to admit it. Having placed the envelopes back on the table, she looked up into the mirror and squinted to check her reflection before turning back to the door.
I could have sworn there was post for Joe. Perhaps Freddy took it for him. Anyway, he'll be about somewhere with those other lads at an airfield. Now, if you don't mind, I can't spend all afternoon jawing away like this.
Thank you, Mrs. Digby. Maisie turned to leave, but held out her hand and pressed it against the door. Oh, just one more question, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Digby sighed the word, elongating it to signal her impatience. Did Joe ever have any visitors?
Visitors?
Digby shook her head.
I don't hold with my lodgers having visitors. I like to know who's under my roof.
She patted the dog, who was fidgeting, racing his little legs as if running in midair. She leaned down to put him on the ground and began speaking again as she once more stood up to her full height, by which time the dog had run to the back of the house as if to attempt to escape from his mistress.
But it's funny you should ask, because someone came to the house asking for Joe Coombs, tall, stringy sort of fellow, about 30, perhaps younger. He was well turned out, I remember that, very tidy, nice tie, good shoes, well polished. I thought he might be family, not that it was any of my business. I told him that Mr. Coombs had moved on with the rest of the crew.
Digby placed her hand over her mouth and whispered through her fingers.
Here I am telling you all this, and forgetting what I should have remembered when that man was stood where you are now. I was told not to say anything to anyone about the lands. It was part of the contract. Not a real contract, not paper, like a solicitor would give you. It was verbal. The man who booked the lodgings said that on no account must I say anything about the lands to anyone who asked. And I was to tell them if anyone came with questions or to visit. He was official, I reckon, from the government. That painting business must be making a pretty penny if someone up in London is going to that sort of trouble.
The kimono had slipped off one shoulder, revealing more of the woman's undergarments than modesty might allow.
Oh, now look at me. Just as well it's you standing there and not Sid Watkins from the ironmongers along the street. All eyes and hands, him.
And with her final comment, she nodded by way of departure and closed the door. Maisie remained in front of the door for a moment before walking back out onto the Winchester Road to collect her motor car. She wondered how the men working for Yates fared in the countryside. Hampshire had not been their first stop, and it would not be their last. Most airfields were situated in rural areas, and the painters were, in general, city men who had grown up on the streets, not close to fields and farms. She wondered if, at the end of a long day, perhaps feeling less than well, given the circumstances of the job gleaned so far, the local pubs might have offered the only place for the young men to relax. On the one hand, that might have given Joe a sense of being at home, or it might have presented him with a dilemma. Too much like home. Pulling up alongside a telephone kiosk, Maisie took the opportunity to place a call to Brenda, who would be at the Dower House, the home bequeathed to Maisie years earlier by her mentor, Dr. Maurice Blanche. Brenda and Maisie's father stayed during the week to care for Anna, the evacuee girl who had been billeted with them. Maisie drove down from London on a Thursday or Friday, returning to her flat in Holland Park on Monday morning, though if she were not busy, it had become easy to linger for one more day, sometimes two.
"The doctor's been," said Brenda. "She came over poorly and was running a temperature, and he says it's definitely measles. The poor little mite is really under the weather. Dr. Stringer says it will run its course, but he said a few of the children locally have gone down with it a lot harder than he's seen before. He reckons the little ones take on more than we think they do, so they're, what did he say? Oh, yes, vulnerable. Mind you, he's young. Got all these newfangled ideas. He told me he wanted to join up in the medical corps, but couldn't on account of his limp. Had polio as a boy, and reckons he's a lucky one because he didn't end up in a wheelchair.
Maisie knew that when her stepmother began to talk without stopping, it was generally because she was worried. "I'll come home as soon as I can. Let's see how she is tomorrow. Is everything else all right?"
"I was getting to everything else. The doctor also says that the outbreak of measles will get worse if they start a second evacuation. There's all those children who went back to London, like those boys who were here, and what with Germany going into Holland and Belgium and now France, they're closer to an invasion. So the boys could come back to us, you never know. The new billeting officer came around today to check on Anna, so I told her she wasn't to be bringing any more children to the house until little Anna was well over the measles."
Maisie put her hand to her forehead. "Oh, poor Anna. Do you need any extra help?"
"A child laying quiet in her bed isn't a nuisance. The Ministry of Health Inspector is, though."
"What do you mean?" Maisie knew the Ministry of Health had jurisdiction over orphan children, and a certain level of influence over where they should be placed. While she had documents signed by Anna's grandmother before the elderly woman succumbed to a respiratory disease, her guardianship of the child could still be challenged. However, Maisie's solicitor had considered the guardianship documents to be solid, at least until the war was over.
"She was checking on the evacuees and knew about Anna's situation, so she was just asking questions about any plans to place her with her family. She didn't want to see her. She only found out about the measles outbreak when she arrived at the school, so she wasn't exactly keen to get close to any children. More's the pity, because I've heard a few things about those poor little tykes over at Turner's farm. They say old Jim Turner has his evacuees out working at 5 in the morning, before they go to school, and as soon as they're home. They're working again. I told the billeting officer about it, but all she could say was that they were a good family, and the children did not seem ill-treated. I felt like telling her to put her glasses on."
Maisie consulted her watch and was about to speak when Brenda began again.
Your father and I take it all in our stride, and Anna is no trouble, even as ill as she is. Emma won't leave her side, and even Duke has been up the stairs to sit in the room, and you know how that dog is with your father. If dogs could get measles, those two hounds would be down with it too by now. Anyway, one more thing. Your friend Priscilla has been on the telephone, wants to know where you are. She says it's important.
Chapter 4. It was Maisie's understanding, having spoken to one of the farm workers before she made her way back to Whitchurch, that there were several Air Force stations within a few miles of the farm. When she considered the reasons for such a cluster, two factors came to mind. The first was proximity to the coast and the ports of Southampton and Portsmouth. Second was the land itself and the flight path bombers might take in the direction of towns to the northeast and to London, though airfields in the southeast, such as Tangmere, Kenley, Hawkinge and Biggin Hill, were situated to protect the capital. More questions queued up to be answered. Why did Yeats not know the exact whereabouts of the crew? Most likely they did, but the fact that they were working on a government contract meant that secrecy was of the utmost importance. She could not expect them to have spoken freely to Billy. He could, after all, have been a spy. And hadn't the whole country been warned about the possibility of Nazi spies lurking among the general population, camouflaged by perhaps a British education and friendly demeanour, or being a good neighbour? But what about Joe? Was his desire to be his own man overriding an ever more serious health condition? A young lad of 15 might not consider it urgent. Perhaps the headaches were easy to brush off. And who was his visitor? Maisie's thoughts darted from one question to the next, as if she had skimmed a stone across the realm of possibilities, and was now watching ripples of suspicion form around the contours of information she had gathered so far. She checked her watch again, a wristwatch, given to her by her late husband, James Compton, and looked up at the darkening sky. One more telephone call before she made her way back to the farm. She dialed the operator, gave the number, placed the requisite number of coins in the slot, and waited until she could hear the ring, and then a voice on the line.
Partridge Residence?
Maisie pressed button A to release the coins and begin the call.
Eleanor, Eleanor, I recognised your lovely Welsh lilt. Is Mrs. Partridge at home?
Oh, hello, Miss Dobbs. I mean, your ladyship.
Maisie cut off the boy's nanny before she completed the little-used title bestowed upon Maisie on the day of her marriage to James.
I have to be quick, Eleanor. I'm in a telephone kiosk in Hampshire, and I only have a few coins on me. Is Mrs. Partridge there?
You just missed her. She's taken the boys, Tim and Tarkin, out for supper.
Is anything wrong? I received a message that she was out of sorts.
It's Tim. Given her a bit of trouble again. As you know, he's not been quite the same since Tom joined the Air Force, and he can't seem to wait until he gets his turn when he comes of an age to be called up. Too keen to join the Navy, that one. But it won't be long, the way things are going, and more likely he'll have to go where they put him, which might be right into the Army.
He does seem to be causing Mrs. Partridge some grief, and he has a sharp tongue on him when he likes, I know that.
He's too much like his mother, quick with the wit, but it can cut like a knife when he wants it to. Between us, she doesn't like it, because she knows where he gets it from.
Oh, dear. I'll be back in London soon, tomorrow afternoon, hopefully, and I can usually get Tim to wind his neck in.
He listens to you, Miss Dobbs.
Maisie was anxious to end the call, but was curious, too.
And what are you doing back in London, Eleanor? I thought you were being sent somewhere with a first aid nursing yeomanry.
Oh, a couple of days leave and some, you know, special training.
Sounds interesting.
Must go now, Miss Dobbs. Bye.
Bye, Ellen.
Maisie pulled the telephone receiver away from her ear and held on to it for a second before returning it to the cradle. Eleanor could be a bit of a chatterbox, so it was not like her to end a telephone conversation first. Indeed, Priscilla had once observed that in the midst of a conversation with Eleanor, one felt rather like an insect caught on sticky flypaper. The boys no longer needed a nanny, but she was so beloved, the family couldn't imagine letting her go. After war was declared, Eleanor had enlisted for service. During her years living with the family in France, she had acquired an admirable proficiency with the French language, and now thought she might be able to use her skill in war work. Priscilla and Douglas made her promise she would come home whenever she was on leave. Her room was kept ready for her return, and she had her own key. Maisie left the telephone kiosk and returned to her motor car. The late May sun was now low in the sky, and darkness would come quickly. As she passed the cottage, occupied by Doreen's aunt, she noticed the drawn blackout curtains, so not even a sliver of light could be seen.
"Oh, thank goodness you're back, Miss Dobbs."
Mrs. Keep was wiping her hands on her apron as Maisie gave a quick knock at the back door of the farmhouse before turning the door handle to enter.
"That road is a bit bumpy, and I was worried you'd lose your way if it got too dark."
"Not to worry, Mrs. Keep. I don't like driving without a light to guide me, so I kept my eye on the time." As she spoke, Mrs. Keep turned away from her and lifted the corner of her apron to her eyes. "Mrs. Keep, is everything all right? Aren't you feeling well?" The woman turned to Maisie.
"It's the news. They think we don't know what they're talking about, the way they give it out. But most of us have lived through one war, and we know the newspapers and the wireless people are using words that mean other things. The army is in retreat in France. They told us 3 days ago that the Germans had broken through Allied lines, and now they're reminding us that they did the same in March 1918 and we still won the war. They're not saying, but I reckon our boys will get stuck, and they're telling us about it a bit at a time, so when the truth really comes out, no one is shocked. That's what my Bill thinks, and he was in the army."
"Oh, Mrs. Keep, you must stand tall. Remain strong."
"Oh, I know, and we are strong. But we've 2 boys, and we think they must be in the thick of it. We don't know for definite, and it's not as if you can ask the army. Bill's just gone out to check the sheep. We're lambing now, you know. Really, he wants to get out of the house, away from the waiting."
Maisie stepped to stand at the woman's side and put an arm around her shoulders. With her free hand, she pulled back a chair from the table and seated the farmer's wife, passing a handkerchief taken from her pocket. "I'll put the kettle on." Mrs. Keep nodded her thanks.
"I don't know what to think," she said. "You bring up your sons on the farm out in the country, and you think they're safe, that the worst that might happen to them is something horrible with the threshing machine. I mean, I lost my brother in the last war, and you think to yourself, no, it can't happen again. Not like the last time, but look at it. Look at us. We're all at it again, fighting each other. It looks like Holland, Belgium and Luxembourg are going to the Nazis, and now France."
She paused, watching as Maisie warmed the teapot before adding tea and boiling water.
"Mind you, they say the Air Force will be going out to protect our soldiers and the Navy. It'll be all hands on deck. Everyone pulling together, you watch."
She sat up, her spine straight, her shoulders back, as if she were convincing herself of the best outcome.
"They didn't break us the last time, and they won't this time. Mark my words."
Yet Maisie felt something snap within her. Priscilla's eldest son had joined the RAF only months earlier, and was now flying, although he was not considered ready for aerial combat. But would that matter in an emergency? Mrs. Keep was right. All hands on deck might be a naval term, yet it extended to those who fought in the air and on the land, as well as the sea. Billy's son, Priscilla's son, Mrs. Keep's boys, It seemed everyone had something to lose, though at that very moment, more than anything, Maisie wanted only to be at Chelstone, drawn back by a feeling that her place was by the bedside of a sick child, one not her own but entrusted to her care. Maisie returned to the telephone kiosk after leaving the farm early the following morning. She placed a call to Chelstone Manor and asked to speak to Lord Julian Compton. Her father-in-law had contacts at the War Office, among other sources that had proven helpful to Maisie over the years.
"Maisie, my dear, how are you?"
Lord Julian's voice had changed of late, and not for the first time. Maisie heard his age in the ragged edges around each word spoken. "Very well, Lord Julian. I'm down in Hampshire. In Whitchurch, actually."
"Oh, you're in the money, then."
Maisie laughed, assuming the elderly man was joking, and perhaps thought that, because she was not in London, she must be on holiday in the country. She continued, "I wonder if you can help me. I'd like to know how many RAF stations there are in the county. Could I get my hands on a list of them?"
"Tricky one, as they're building more, especially in that area. There's about 23, 24, I would imagine, or there will be once they're all operational."
"How many?" Maisie was shocked. "In one county?"
"And if you're looking at proximity, you're not far from Wiltshire, and there's more there, of course, in Dorset, and so on. I was just talking to a War Office colleague yesterday, former RAF man. He'd come down to pay a visit to the Canadian officers billeted here at Chelstone, and he was telling me they should have hundreds more airfields operational within months. Getting ready to meet the Luftwaffe on their own terms, I would imagine. That's certainly what our boys are doing at the moment."
Maisie had never known Lord Julian to be so forthcoming. He had always been helpful, yet measured in his responses. Perhaps it was because she was family now, united in grief over the loss of their only son. Over the years, Lord Julian and his wife, Rowan, had come to love her, and she had come to love them in return. "That explains something. I'm looking into the apparent disappearance of a young apprentice painter and decorator. The business he works for landed a government contract to paint air stations with a special emulsion, a fire retardant, so they've been going from place to place, spending a good amount of time in each location and painting every building inside and out."
"There will be plenty of work for them, without doubt. And you say he's missing?"
"At the moment, it might be more accurate to say not accounted for by his parents. He could well just be ill and in bed at his lodgings and doesn't want them to know. He's had headaches ever since he started the work. Apparently the emulsion has a heavy vapour."
Yes. Fire retardant. Definitely needed on those buildings. They'll be in the line of attack."
There was a second's hiatus in the conversation. "Lord Julian, the war is close now, isn't it?"
"It was always close, my dear. Close isn't simply a question of distance. The threat of war has been lingering over our heads since Adolf Hitler came to power. It was only a matter of time before we reached this point, but I don't think we could have ever foreseen having hundreds of thousands of our men at such peril, almost beyond our reach. The RAF is moving farther into France to ward off the Luftwaffe, trying to give us a chance."
Lord Julian cleared his throat.
"Anyway, look, I can get you a list of all those RAF stations in Hampshire. Apart from the ports, it must be considered somewhat safe. After all, if it's good enough for the Bank of England."
The gravelly voice tapered off. "I don't understand." Maisie fingered a coin ready to press into the slot should more money be required for the call.
"Their operations were moved to the county. After all, you cannot have the country's financial arm at risk in the city, not with its proximity to the Thames and the docks. And it's not a surprising choice. After all, they print the money down there, so it's considered safe enough. That's why I said you were in the money. Not terribly good at quips, though.
I'm afraid you've lost me, Lord Julian.
I suppose it's a well-kept open secret, as well as the odd brewery and, of course, silk and agriculture. The place you're in is known for printing money. It's not all done in London, you know, and as